Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today. And now, the second half of the influence of the gospel on literature, with your host, Pastor John Ehlers.
We'd like to welcome back to the Lutheran Inquisitor, Dr. Susan Bachman. She's professor of rhetoric and the director of the Concordia University Irvine Cambridge Overseas Studies Program in conjunction with our Theological House of Studies, Westfield House in Cambridge. And last week, Susan, we began our discussion on literature and its connection with the gospel by looking at an old English poem and hymn, and very much enjoyed that. Now we're going to switch gears a little bit and go back across the pond to the U.S. and talk a little bit about Mark Twain and some of his literature, particularly Huckleberry Finn. Now, I remember in high school, we had to read Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and I've read Innocents Abroad and Life on the Mississippi, and I love Twain, but I've never made this sort of faith connection with Twain before. But can you give us perhaps a little bit of background about Samuel Clemens or Mark Twain?
Mark Twain is, to my mind, the first and really first greatest world-acknowledged literary figure who put the United States on the map. There had been generations of great poets and novelists before, but none struck a chord so strongly and loudly around the world as his stories of Tom Sawyer and then the richer, more analytic piece called Huckleberry Finn. Unfortunately today, because there are some uncomfortable parts in Huckleberry Finn and words that we are careful not ever to use in polite company, there's been arguments that we shouldn't read it. Well, I'd say that's throwing out the baby with the bathwater. We can learn from these historic experiences and the changes in language and literature. And Huckleberry Finn is a gold mine. So I'll talk a little bit about Mark Twain. But here's a question for you, John. Put you on the spot. You speak as if you've read some things. So do you know what the name Mark Twain means and why he chose it?
I do not.
Oh, I am so glad, because I love to have students who miss questions on the quizzes, and then I get to teach things. So, Samuel Clemens was a native son of the state of Missouri. He's associated with the town on the Mississippi River called Hannibal, and he grew up watching all the river boats go up and down the river. It was so exciting. It would be, I don't know what it would be like today, like watching a superhighway and seeing what the really fastest and most exciting cars would be or something, or the biggest trucks. But he watched all the paddle boats, and they would come in, and it was important for riverboat captains to know how deep the water was. And they had measuring sticks, and a mark was a 6-foot mark, if I remember rightly. And if they said, Mark Twain, that meant you had 12 feet of, it sort of sung out that they would tell everybody, we've got plenty of space, so we're not going to run aground. And he heard that over again. And so when he decided not to write under his own name, but he would write under a pseudonym, then that's where he got that name.
Very good. Thank you very much. Now, we're looking, as you say, at Huckleberry Finn. And as you say, this happened, many years ago. So what can we learn from this sort of barefooted character wandering the rivers and the byways of the state of Missouri?
Well, first of all, Huckleberry Finn is, he's a real boy. He's really depicted as a little trampy boy, a scamp who gets away with tricks and so on. And he comes from a lousy home, wasn't cared for and so on. So in many ways, he does for audiences, or did for audiences and still can do today, what Harry Potter has done for the English students, recognizing miserable home life, but yet had sparks of genius and brilliance and a good heart. So what, you don't go to literature, at least in my opinion, you don't go to literature directly for a moral message or to find this is a Christ figure. I mean, you might certainly do that at some point. Or this is, and you don't import your faith or religion into it in a wooden sort of way. You read it on its own terms, and you find the touch points with the questions in your own life about faith, about morality, about what kinds of people there are in the world. Some novels are just horrific, telling about terrible things that no one would ever want to experience. But you learn about people's reactions to those. And so in Huckleberry Finn, I guess if I had to put a thesis sentence, I would struggle to say Huckleberry Finn takes us into all sorts of bywaters, and we watch his mind at work, struggling with what is right and what is wrong, struggling to put his own conscience and his own ideas over against the teachings of what he had heard. But what he has heard that we hear through him is pretty fractured Christianity. It's a pretty kind of wooden, moralistic approach to things. It's like little kids. What do they hear from us? We only little fragments. It's not your whole message. So through Huck, we see all of our own struggles. And so, especially in this book, which is just delightful, it's long. And you shouldn't ever read in a hurry just to get done, but read and dip into a chapter and let it sort of roll on your tongue a little bit. Don't try to rush through. Today I want to talk about the raft episode, and especially Huck's conscience problems in chapter 16, but Twain takes us on a descriptive journey. We're with him on his raft. We're with him when he talks to shady characters, when he interacts with his friends, when he interacts with adults who are not very moral themselves. Do you remember those episodes, or some of them, the favorite ones, or maybe even the one about Tom Sawyer? I know you'd know that one about the fence.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that, because this is almost like a sequel, isn't it? Because Tom Sawyer, if I recall rightly, is the first book, and then it's followed up with Huck Finn, and Twain uses the characters from the first book in the second book and draws them out. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And he sets everything in and around Hannibal. Along the river. The river is important to him because Mark Twain himself became a really master pilot of these paddle wheel boats. Other bits of his writing, nonfiction writing, go into some of those skills and those descriptions. But in Tom Sawyer and then Huckleberry Finn, you're in the Hannibal area, populated with people you get to know with all their foibles. The kindly women and bumbling men and so on. But the one that everyone knows from Tom Sawyer is how Tom Sawyer got the fence painted, because he was so clever. And every time, we even have a joke in our family that a little bit, my husband will say, yeah, if you believe that, I got 25 cents, you know, to get my fence painted or something. So it can be a joke. Literature does that. When people have read the same things, you make allusions, you make references to things, and it's sort of a shorthand, because with like-minded people, you can, in just a very short time, say something like, yeah, Tom Sawyer's fence, and everyone knows what you're about. In Huckleberry Finn, he picks up with many of the same characters, but he goes much more philosophically, much more deeply into things, but never, ever losing the fact that we really are talking to people who are believable. So that was, Twain just had a genius. He also later served as at one point in his life, he served as a reporter for the Sacramento Bee, and he wrote things in the western part of the United States as well. But in later in life, he came back and took all of his understanding about human nature and poured it into these books, which have become so beloved and so worth reading and learning about.
And he dealt with real issues for that time, slavery, Indians, and these were all folks that Huck Finn ran across on his journeys up and down the river.
Right, and people who were, I don't know, I guess the word that I would use is from the Yiddish, I would call them shysters, people who are tricksters, people who are out to get money and to cheat people. And you see all of that through his eyes, and he uses some of those kinds of people in his own way, and Huck himself is a bit of a trickster. He knows how to wiggle himself out of bad or hard situations. But the slavery one is just world-class, wonderful. And in the book, and I won't have time to read a whole chapter on the radio, but chapter 16 has been made famous by scholars, and especially one scholar named Jonathan Bennett, who a number of decades ago started off a whole almost now industry of people talking about the conscience of Huckleberry Finn, specifically with regard to slavery and the conscience issues and so on. I really enjoy thinking about this young boy as he struggles in his heart with what he thinks is the right thing to do. But then he goes back and forth, and this chapter 16, without ever losing our attention, the scenery, everything that's going on around it, you see Jim, the slave, and Huck have agreed to escape from all the things that are binding them to the sort of stiff culture of their time, with Jim being a slave and Huck being under the thumb of people who want always to civilize him. And he rebels against that. So they build a raft and they go down the Mississippi River. And their goal, and if you read it in the book, you would say their goal was the city of Cairo. It looks like Cairo, Egypt. But oh my goodness, in Missouri, it's Cairo. You've got to say Cairo. So they're trying to go from Hannibal down to Cairo because that's going to be where they can go across the river into non-slave territory. And it's this way of getting Jim into freedom territory, and for Huck to whatever, like when kids run away, you know, they have only vague notions of where they're going to go and so on. But Huck and Jim have adventures. They travel through the along the river, but they travel at night. Now, this has to be dangerous and scary as all get out. So you have to respect these people who knew the snags and crags of the river. But they would travel at night, and then they would conceal themselves during the day with trees and brushes along the river. And they would fish and they would cook. It just sounds like an ideal camping trip in many ways. But it really was a scary thing to be, first of all, for a white little boy to be taking a black slave would have been a hanging sort of offense without any question. And they had adventures along the way. But Huck has conscience adventures. He thinks over in his head, Jim is a wonderful person. He deserves his freedom. And his wife is in slavery elsewhere, and also his children. So Huck has gotten into this plan. But somewhere along the line, he begins thinking about, but what about those people who in good faith bought Jim or bought his wife? What have I done to hurt them? And so he has huge struggles in his conscience about what he's doing. And he gets to the point that he's going to row over, tells Jim he's going to see if they've gotten to Cairo yet and see if he can raise some people. Jim can't be seen on the river because he would be seen as a runaway, but Huck can. He can go and he can, you know, buy bread or cheese or whatever they need along the way to eat in addition to the food that they catch. But he goes and he tries to find out where they are, but his intention, and he didn't tell Jim this, his intention is that he's going to turn him in, because he's feeling guilty about the widow who had bought Jim, who was a slave and so on. But along the way, as he's rowing over toward the shore, he rethinks. And Jim had said something like, Huck, you're the best person for me. You have done, I just will never forget you, and so on. And that works in Huck. And it reawakens the conscience. And of course, from today's perspective, we see that Huckleberry Finn is doing the right thing by trying to get this slave to freedom. But you can't just import modern morality or modern Christian ideas. You have to enter the world that he's in. And Twain depicts this deliberation just exquisitely. You have to read it better than listening to my summary, but in finally, he turns around and comes back and rejects his exposure of Jim, and eventually they get go on down the road. But that chapter is one of the most philosophical, but it's philosophy in a way that's so delightful to follow. You come away from it feeling as if you had a good think about something and it wasn't painful at all. And I think that's what literature ought to do.
Thank you, Dr. Bachman, for this refresher in the life of Huckleberry Finn. We see that sometimes it appears God puts us, even literary characters, in places that are uncomfortable, and it makes us think, and we really have to struggle with which direction our path may go. I mean, and that's a very common thing, even for Christians, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think the thing that Huckleberry Finn shows us is the struggle people feel when they have been taught this is a certain right way to believe or to go, but yet something else raises questions, and maybe it's in a time of social, political, or moral awareness changes. And Huck Finn gives us the book Huck Finn gives us a picture of the boy Huck going through the struggles of, what do I do now? I'm sort of damned if I do and damned if I don't. And my conscience isn't going to help me because I'm feeling bad if I go one way and I'm feeling bad the other way. So I think at the end of this chapter, or at least the next chapter, Huck and Jim decide, what we're going to have to do is make this up as we go along and do what feels right. Now, not in that sort of go with the force, Luke, Star Wars kind of thing, just go with your gut all the time, but thoughtfully, reflectively. And if Huck Finn is anything, he sounds like he's anti philosophy or something, but he's a great philosopher. So Huck will mull it over and will be the great observer of the people around him, a critic of the church, yes, but he still has absorbed an awful lot of what the church has taught, which is a little bit a metaphor for Twain himself, I believe, in his relationship with the established church.
It is interesting that we see here things that, as you mentioned, a solid Christian background, things that you've learned, or at least in fragments, having to play out in some real difficult situations. But Twain can even use humor to poke fun at us, and that's not always a bad thing either.
You know, I think Twain is just, I go back and read short stories of his even now that I know the ending, but I'm still chuckling along the way because he writes things so well. There's a great stories about him being caught out in the snow with a bunch of people who are lost in the snow, and they all think that they're going to die, and they have their resolutions, like bargaining with God, you know, oh my God, if you only let me get out of here, I'll give up smoking, I'll give up drinking, I'll give up whatever. And I'm not going to ruin and give a spoiler for the end of that, but it's a great story, and Twain is just on the money when it comes to capturing what human beings, how they think, and how they wiggle themselves in and out of rationalities and so on. But with the slave issue, the thing that we bring to that issue is how many, 150 and in England even more years of having abolished slavery and having it be sort of a thing you have to assume, that without which is no culture, that slavery is just not a human thing anymore, that is worth even arguing about. But in those days, oh my goodness, it was really hotly argued by people who were trying to do the right thing, judging from what they felt in their faith and their religion. So you read a book like this to enter into the world, but then you also apply it to your own struggles. I think similarly, we find in the Old Testament book of Ruth, Ruth and her mother-in-law all were put in changing cultural circumstances where the outsiders of a culture were shunned. I mean, we're so welcoming of other cultures and globalization and that sort of thing these days that all that seems very foreign. But with a sympathetic reading of scripture, you see that we have also some of the same sorts of struggles of how do you act? How do you proceed when you don't have a rule book that tells you? And if Christianity is anything, it's sort of anti-rule bookishness. With all the Pharisees always coming out with, well, I got the right answer. No, you don't. So, anyway, I would say read Huckleberry Finn, both for the delight of literature, the wording, the characterization, the painting of pictures, but also read it to raise questions about what is the role of our conscience in faith and that sort of thing. Does that make sense?
It does. And as I hear you talk about it, I can't help but think of the little book in the New Testament, Philemon, where Paul writes to his friend Philemon, as Paul has been assisted by a runaway slave named Onesimus. And Paul writes to Philemon, who is Onesimus's owner, saying, you know, you owe your very life to me, Onesimus. I am the one who brought the gospel to you. And now Onesimus is here helping me. He's been a great service to me in the Lord, and I'm sending him back to you. I want you to treat him right. I want you to do what's right by him. And again, you have this real play between the slavery and the freedom that we have in Christ and how we deal with each other. And it was a real issue in New Testament as well as 150, 200 years ago.
I think the celebration of human ability to write, and that doesn't mean just writing on a sheet of paper, but to write, to create scenarios, to create people and characters, should be acknowledged as a God-pleasing gift that then can benefit others, but not in this straightforward plunkety-plunk, well, this is a good character, she's a nice person in the book, therefore that's Christian. Sometimes we're too simplistic that way. Now, again, audience awareness, you start out with children who are age 3 and 4 and 5 with the simplest versions of stories. But by the time a child can read things like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, children are able to discern what is important to them and the questions to raise over a lifetime. We talked a week ago about memorization. And I remember many poems that people made me remember, and I remember hymns from singing them over and over in church. And, you know, those things pop into your head at time of need. Similarly with literature, even though I haven't had to memorize any parts particularly of Huckleberry Finn, I'm so grateful to my English teacher. I had to memorize 200 lines of Macbeth. And you'll say, well, what good is that? Well, I suppose if I were ever on a quiz show, maybe I'd win some money for that. But things that you remember, phrases from characters in novels, in plays, in poems, and so on, can live in your heart and come out years later and interact with a situation where you're in a new situation. The world changes around us. So we're all Rip Van Winkles in many ways. We blink our eye and 20 years of something. I'm old enough and have grandchildren, so I know that I seem like a fossil to them in some ways. But every now and again, some of the same stories click, and Huckleberry Finn has been a perennial favorite.
And I do think it's important to keep stories like Huckleberry Finn alive, where we're wrestling with issues such as slavery, because I think we can fall into the idea that we are better than the people of the past, when in actuality I was reading a draft report last week, and slavery has not gone away. In fact, there is more slavery today than there ever has been in the world, with human trafficking and the stealing of people and using them for the sex trade or forced labor. It is still a horrible, terrible problem that our society has to deal with. And so these stories, again, I think still speak loudly and clearly to us even today.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, of course. Anybody who is not aware of how fractured our world is just has to start reading. I read what Americans would call a more liberal press, and I read the more conservative press. But from either direction, you get a pretty fractured view of the world, certainly no less evil than in the days of Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer and so on. And the tendency to pontificate from our morally superior viewpoints on one particular thing is a pretty much sidelined. I think today the clash of cultures from different faiths, different religions, needs to be met with discussions, respect, listening greatly. But sometimes the illustrations from literature can give you that entree, that distance, that step back that makes you not sound like somebody that's hitting over anybody else over with a baseball bat, the distance you need to talk to people sometimes can be met by referring to, of course, today's young people will talk about film, TV shows, and so on, but also classic books like Tom Sawyer or many others. One of the ones that's very well read in across generations in the United States is To Kill a Mockingbird, and that was written by Harper Lee from the state of Alabama many years ago, and depicts a racially charged South. It could also have been a racially charged North, because neither side had the moral high ground when it comes to racial difficulties. But I think the distance that literature allows you enables that kind of objectivity is maybe a little bit too strong. But you can talk to people, and once you talk to people, you discover underneath what looks like unmeetable difference, you might find commonalities, just as I had mentioned last week about the Anglo-Saxons, that entering an Anglo-Saxon world, the missionaries had to find common ground. And sometimes I think literature and a character or an episode of something that gets about in the culture, the saddest thing is if people don't know your references. And so if you haven't read Huckleberry Finn, then you won't get the references and you can't enter the conversation.
So when we're reading a piece of secular literature, what should we look for to help us make those connections with the Christian message?
Each according to his skills and interests, and what you bring to the book is going to, I can't say what kind of hymn is best, because it's different ones will click with different people. But I would say read honestly and openly, and read to remember maybe smaller amounts of things, and focus on something that you really can dig into and remember. And so you might look at particular kinds of characters. I read different books. In fact, some stories I have taught for almost 20 years, the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. I've taught the particular one, Silver Blaze, every semester for about 15 years at Concordia. And each time I reread the story to teach in a new semester, and I'd see different things. I come from different places. So don't read just once. If something's really good, go back and read the good parts again and see, how is this inspirational? Where does it give me an idea how to connect with a certain kind of person I'm talking to, or with a book reading group or something like that? Books change for you upon different readings. So go in and look for one thing one time, and don't beat yourself up if you don't remember everything. I had a graduate professor one time say, "Susan, you don't have to read every book from page 1 to page 451. Dig in and out. Stop after the second chapter if it's boring to you. Put it down. You've already gotten some good out of it. You know what's there. Don't read something you hate. Don't throw it away yet. Put it on your shelf. Don't throw away a book if you haven't, you know, at least given it a chance. But put it on your shelf. You may be in a mood for that some other time. But when you go to literature, look for different things at different times, and be satisfied with that. And some things do bear reading over and over. I'll put in a plug for Daily Chapel here at Westfield House. We go daily to church, and we hear the sequence of scripture passages through all different books, all of Jeremiah, all of big chunks of Isaiah, or through the book of Exodus, whatever. And getting to hear daily all those stories that I've known for all the years, the decades of my life, to hear them again and to see different things each time, it's very refreshing. Good books bear hanging on to and rereading and looking at again. But also, don't ever let a book make you feel guilty, because it's intended to enlighten you. And don't read while you're multitasking. That's impossible. You know, find a comfortable and quiet place to read on your own. Make reading be something that you want to do. Be able to put it down. Get yourself some pretty colored markers if you're writing on a paper. If you're working on an electronic, mark passages that you like with certain colors. I always put vocabulary words in that bright orange, words that I need to point out to students. You know, if they don't know what ostensible means, then they're going to miss the understanding of the sentence. But I use for passages that I like, I put in blue. So I'm color friendly. Literature should be lively. And there's an alliterative quote for you, literature and liveliness.
Well, thank you for helping bring some liveliness to our talk of literature and its connection with the gospel. We thank you very much, Dr. Bachman, for your insights, and we look forward to carrying on our conversation next week.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.